You are listening to The Activity Pod with Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, where we help you stay focused so you can get stuff done. In today's show, episode 19, we interview Dr. Anita Heiss. Anita is best known for being a writer, a lifetime ambassador of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, and a proud member of the Wiradjuri Nation of Central New South Wales. We talk to Anita about her very structured approach to her day and to her writing. And we also talk to her about what it is to be a creative disruptor and meeting fantastic people via Twitter, including me. You can find this episode at theactivitypod.com/19. That's number 19. And if you enjoy listening to our show, please let us know by giving us a shout out on Twitter or Facebook at The Activity Pod. Thanks very much for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to The Activity Pod, where your hosts, Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, talk accountability and focus on helping you get stuff done so you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want to from life. And now, here are your hosts, Annette and Mel.
Our guest today is Dr. Anita Heiss. Anita is the author of non-fiction, historical fiction, commercial women's fiction, poetry, social commentary, and travel articles. She is a regular guest at writers' festivals and travels internationally performing her work and lecturing on Indigenous literature. She is a lifetime ambassador of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation and a proud member of the Wiradjuri Nation of Central New South Wales. She is an adjunct professor with Jumbunna She is an adjunct professor with Jumbunna Indigenous House of Learning at UTS and currently divides her time between writing, public speaking, emceeing and being a creative disruptor. Anita was a finalist in the 2012 Human Rights Awards and the 2013 Australia of the Year Awards. Her most recent novel is Harry's Secret, and she recently relocated to Brisbane to manage the Epic Good Foundation. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you.
Thank you for that lovely introduction.
I didn't know you were an Australian of the Year finalist until I Googled you yesterday.
Well, I have to say, when I got a phone call saying that I was a finalist, I thought it was a joke because I don't actually celebrate Australia Day, so I thought of it. So I had to say, are you sure? Who's ringing me? But I was actually nominated by Reconciliation Australia, and it is an honour that somebody thinks that you are worthy of a title of, I was a finalist in the category of local hero with other amazing people who I've since gone on to want to support in their work as well. So that's a good thing.
I like that. So the first thing we want to ask is, how do you fit everything in? Because that's a very long and impressive list of activities that you have going on.
Well, obviously I have about 38 hours in a day. I don't have a man and I don't have kids. So already I have more time than a lot of my people in my world. So I have more time to do the things that are important to me. Like the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, like writing, which I love doing, which mightn't generate the income to pay the mortgage, but it's something that is very, very important to me. So I am quite structured, to be in all seriousness. I'm very structured in the way I approach my day. I'm very scheduled, so I box things into time frames and so forth, so that I make sure that every single day has the element of work, but also has an element of health and an element of fun and family and quite a lot of Anita time.
Mm, sounds great. Mm. So that's a really good tip to sort of segment your day out in terms of what's important to you, whether it be work or health or whatever else is important in your life in that moment.
Well, it's interesting, Annette, because I'm just having this conversation with you right now. I'm thinking to myself, when did you become like that, Anita? Because it's interesting because I very much compartmentalize my life, but by doing that, I make sure for me that everything gets a fair go. And I've learned over time. I had a life coach. I got a life coach in 2000 and 2002, I think I started seeing my life coach, mm-hmm. 2003. So I've had a relationship with her, Geraldine Starr at Stunmond, for going on 13 years now. And over the course of working through my priorities, what I wanted to do, what was important to me, because at that, when I started with her, it was saying yes to everything related to work, mm-hmm. feeling guilty about saying no. And I learned from her that every time I said yes to somebody else, I was putting what I wanted to do in my own personal goals and or personal and professional goals and to the bottom of the list.
Yes.
So what I learned over time was how to do exactly what I wanted to do. You were just raising it, the health, mm-hmm. the friends, the work, and so forth, fitting it all in balance into a day. So right now, a normal day, and I've learnt this also about having spent some time in Brisbane, which is a much slower pace of life than my 40 years in Sydney.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, I every single day begins almost every single day with some form of exercise. So this morning I ran 8 kilometres with my boss, and then we had a breakfast meeting, and so I could do all of that by 8:30. I've already knocked over quite, you know, my exercise and a significant important meeting for the day, had some nutrition, and I'm at my desk by 8:30. So every day there's my exercise, I walk or run or whatever. I like to be at my desk by 8:30, having had a coffee with someone either at the State Library of Queensland or at my office in Cordelia Street with the Epic Good Foundation. Mm-hmm. And basically I'll know by the end of the day, you know, I do a list of priorities, what my deadlines are. If I'm working on a novel, I say, right, by the end of the day, I want to have 2,500 words minimum done. So I'll have a specific goal for myself, and I prioritise what's important. For instance, I thought I had a podcast recording at 9 o'clock this morning. It's actually 10 o'clock. But during that hour, that extra, I knocked over a whole lot of admin that I would have done at the end of the day. So I call it personal admin, paying the bills, personal emails, updating my website. That all goes to the end of the day or at home.
Yep. Mm. Oh, well, that knocked out my first question then. Do you have a morning routine that sets you up for the day? Well, do you run every day, or is there an alternate exercise that you do?
I run every second day. Mm. I have been or I'll walk, and I've had knee problems, so what I've realized is I need to not be running every day. Yeah. But I'm training for my next half marathon.
Oh,
so you do need to clock quite a few miles each week.
Yes.
So I'm conscious of that. So I'm going to try and get into the pool tomorrow afternoon when there's nobody around and I can brave myself in a swimsuit in public. Yeah, ladies, you know what I'm talking about.
I do, having just bought 2, and I bought them online, mind you.
Oh, that's
yes, I know. So I was a bit hesitant opening the package. However, I'm pleased to announce that they fit.
Some product placement.
I'm really curious. How did you get started as a writer?
That's a good question. And I have to say, as a child, I never imagined as a young person that I would now in 2016 be releasing. I think this year I will release my 18th book by the end of the year.
That's fantastic.
No idea. I wasn't a reader as a child, and I get embarrassed telling kids in school that, because I'm telling them they must read. But I was a tomboy. The 70s were very different. I didn't come from a home with books, and I was out on the street playing cricket and footy with the boys, and we didn't have libraries like we have them today. We had God, I make myself sound so old. We had the bus that came around. It would park for a week, and you'd go and borrow the books from the council bus.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So
yes, I remember that.
That was in the 70s.
Yes,
and so
I loved those bus libraries.
It's so different now, and I look at the State Library of Queensland, which is the best library in Australia, hands down, with, you know, not only its collection but the range of ways in which to enjoy the library space and so forth. So I wasn't a reader, but what happened was when I went to university and I was doing my honours degree on the 1967 referendum, I realised all the books that I got off the shelf in order to complete my thesis we're pretty much about anything to do with Aboriginal Australia, we're pretty much written by non-Indigenous people. And some of those books are written by people that had never been to Australia. Yes. And so this was, for me, this was like wanting to go and write an essay or a thesis on you know, women's studies and all the books being written by men, which is something that we would never, ever tolerate. Or deem acceptable or think valid in terms of, you know, producing a piece of literature. So that's where I became aware of the need for Aboriginal people to write their own stories. Now, I didn't think I would be a writer from that, but what I did do is I wrote one book, which was meant to be a satirical look at white Australian society, culture, the backyard barbecue, Skippy, Vegemite, all those sort of things, as a stand-up to say, well, this is what it looks like if, you know, being that I was raised bicultural because my father was Austrian, my mother Aboriginal, so I was raised in a house where I was socialised and educated through non-Indigenous systems, but always very strong in identity. So that book was meant to be like a bit of an experiment, and that I then went on to do my PhD on Aboriginal literature and publishing and lived on the Mohawk Reserve in Canada, working on their newspaper, and I became more and more interested in the production of and publishing around First Nations writing. And so I went and did my PhD, and then I wanted to learn about self-publishing, so I self-published a book of poetry that sold really well for poetry. And then I got invited to write a book for Scholastic, which is called Who Am I? The Diary of Mary Talents on the Stolen Generations, and that's since been translated into French, Spanish, Farsi, and Mandarin. And then it sort of snowballed, and I like being able to create a form of writing that reaches different audiences about issues that are important to me, because most people aren't going to sit on the bus with a non-fiction academic text, but they might read a novel or read a travel article or, you know, read some poetry or some, or whatever. And I think there's a huge opportunity to fill so many gaps in the Australian literary landscape. And basically, so it's all snowballed since then.
Fantastic. So you said in another interview that you're quite strategic as a writer. What do you mean by that?
There's two. Well, my process is basically, you know, have an idea, and then I write a synopsis. So I've only learned how to do this probably on my 10th book, and I find writing the synopsis is much harder than actually writing the 90,000 words for the novel, because in the synopsis, which will be anything between 300 and 1,000 words, you have to know what the story is going to be. Nail it. What is the story? And this is my selling document. So I'll get a contract on two pages, whereas most people write their manuscript and then have to sell the book. Publisher now will say, right, you know, Ned's got a track record. She's written us two pages. This is what the book's going to be about. So it's about, I write my synopsis, then I go and do then I do my character breakdown. So I've got my novel set in Brisbane called Titters. There's five main characters set in five suburbs around Brisbane. So I write each character, one page on each character. What do they look like? What are their quirks? What's their personalities? What's their relationship background and so forth? So when I start to write, I already know what these characters are about.
They're living and breathing already.
I know what they are. Now then I go and do my research. So I lived in the suburbs that my characters lived in, which were West End, Kangaroo Point, Paddington. I didn't live in Upper Brookfield, but I spent time up there, sat in the cemetery, sat at the general store and so forth, and the Gap. And so I do all my research and then I start writing. So the writing side for me is the least strenuous part of the process. For me, the research is the biggest part of the process. I spend more time researching than I would spend writing. And then I actually send it out for feedback. So I've just finished a novel set in Cowra about the Cowra breakout World War II. So I've sent that over to Japan, and I've sent it to four people in Cowra to read drafts, because I want it to be, it's a novel, but historically it needs to be correct. There's also two types of writers. One is a panster and one is a plotter. Have you heard of this?
Do tell. No, I haven't.
Ladies.
Yes, I have.
We're not pantsing anybody. But
Now, that's an old 70s term.
Yes. So a panster is someone who literally just flies by the seat of their pants. They sit down and they just write. Yep. I am the opposite. I'm a plotter, and there's far more pansters than there are plotters. Yeah. Now, a plotter maps the entire book out.
Wow.
Like so I'll do an essay plan for the entire book, chapter by chapter. Now, right. It's very structured. So yeah. It's like my day. I'm really very structured.
Yeah.
However, and I don't find that at all limiting. It actually makes it. See, I don't have writer's block because if I get stuck on something in chapter 2, I already know what's going to happen in chapter 16, so I can just go and start working there.
Right.
Now, the difference between my friends who are pansters and myself is I'll have a book come out every year. Or I have 3 coming out this year because of the way that I structure and plot. And for me, it is about time.
Mm.
It is about time. I've got lots of stories I want to write. I haven't got time to sit down and stare out the window and, you know.
So have you, do you think you have learnt that strategy, or is it a natural, one of your natural skills and abilities to be able to do that in such a structured manner?
That's a really good question. I never thought about why I was like that. Why am I like that? I think it probably stemmed from my academic background where you would, you know, do my PhD and you had a chapter heading and you'd have what do you want to go in that chapter. And then on my first novel that I ever wrote was in a diary format. So it was very lineal.
Yes.
And all my novels just literally got very straightforward and they just pass over time. And for me, the hard work is meant to be with the writer, not with the reader.
Yes.
So my desire in writing a novel or any book is to pretty much simplify an area that's complex for many people,
mm-hmm.
and that they can read it in a kid's novel or an adult novel or a historical novel or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was a good question. I think probably it was my academic training. But and the thing is, I really like working that way.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So you don't really have a problem with staying focused then. When you sit down, do you have a certain time of day that you sit down to write, or when the feeling strikes, or do you plot that out throughout your day?
Yeah, no, that's a good question as well. I write in blocks of time. So I will probably, I spent 6 weeks in Barcelona this year and I wrote every morning at the local cafe from, you know, 9. I was out of there by 12.
Yeah.
So, and then that's done for the day. I'm done for the day and I'm exhausted mentally. So there were people who will write, you know, I don't know how they do it, 12 hours on end. If I could, 4 hours, 5 hours, absolutely tops.
Yep.
Editing is a different thing, but I'm a morning person, so I was up at 5 o'clock last week working on edits.
Yeah.
There is no way I could do that at 10 o'clock at night. If it's not done by 6 o'clock, it doesn't get done that day. Because the evening is my time. It's catching up on personal emails and it's watching Everybody Loves Raymond or something on TV.
Yep. Yeah. So do you have any tips or tools that you use to help you write, and what advice do you have for someone who wants to write a novel? Where do they start?
Again, really good question. My greatest tip is to just start writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I meet a lot of people, even in my circle, they want to write a book. And as soon as I tell them, well, you need to start writing, here's some books you should read in that genre, I can see on their face already, too hard. They don't want to do the hard yards. So they think it's just going to be fun and they're going to write. And I say to them, if you're writing it for someone to read, you need to read other people's books because that's our homework. You need to know what works on the page. You need to know what's in the marketplace because everybody might have a story, but why does anybody have to read your story?
Mm.
And why would somebody read your book if you can't be bothered reading somebody else's book? So you really, it's about understanding how the industry works. It's about understanding why is a book at the airport and why are some books at the airport and why are some books not there and so forth. And I won't lie to you, I like seeing my books at the airport.
Absolutely.
That is a motivation. The other thing is writer's centres are fantastic for, being part of a writing community. I wouldn't be where I am today had I not joined the Australian Society of Authors in 1996, I think I joined, to start being around professional writers. And we all do it in our different areas of our life. We join, professional communities and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think writers, since getting a mentor, having a writing buddy, there are writers groups for every genre, everything you want to do, or set up your own writing group. Or where you meet once a month and you have to bring 2,000 words. I know of some writers' groups where, you know, they set up some online community and every month you've got to upload your 2,000 words and everybody in the group reads them, and then they meet at somebody's house and they have 25 glasses of wine. And guess what? Everybody's works reads perfectly. But I think it's sort of like the running thing. So I think running and writing are very similar. So this morning I ran with someone who runs faster than me, and I knocked off 2 kilometres because they pushed me off 2 minutes off my time, sorry. Now, with the writing thing, if you are in a group, and there is the expectation for you to deliver something, you will do that, as opposed to going, okay, well, this month I'm going to write 2,000 words. But if you're not accountable to anybody, then it might not happen. So I think I've got something on my blog about writing tips that people can access. And on a really quick story, my brother's texted me one night saying, I just wrote the first chapter of my book. It's going to be called Being Mr. Right, and it's going to sit on the shelf in the shop since your book, which is my book's called Not Being Mr. Right, Not Needing Mr. Right. And I said, that's fantastic. When did you write? He goes, I wrote it in the shower. And I said, how did you get the laptop in the shower? And he said, oh, no, it's in my head. And I said, nobody can read a book that's in your head. Biggest tip, start writing.
If you're looking for voiceover talent, then get in touch with our voiceover guy, Steve Mendel. Steve is also a consultant, coach, and presenter, and you can find him via his website, stevemendel.com.au. And that's S-T-E-V-E-M-E-N-D-L. Thanks, Steve. You mentioned that you recommend books to read. Any particular books that you would recommend?
Well,
or was that just whatever was being discussed at the time?
Right. No. So if you wanted to write a book about Brisbane, I would say get into one of the fantastic bookshops in your local area. In Brisbane, you would go to Avid Reader or River Bend Books, and you would say, what have you got from local writers about Brisbane? So you could see what's already been written, because you don't want to read, you don't point writing, you know, something the same. So read in the genre that you're working in. If you're writing a historical novel, I would start reading historical novels. I meet a lot of people who say, I want to write my memoir. I go, right, get to the library. Say to the librarian, what can you give me on memoirs about cancer survivors, right, if that's what you're writing about, right? And read, so you can see the tone that people are using, the structure they used in the story, whether or not they use photos. So then you can make decisions about how you want to tell your story. But having said that, you also need to read across genres, so you can get a diversity of voice and style and so forth. Now, the other thing is books to read in terms of building up your writing skills. I would look at Kate Grendel's got a fantastic book called The Writing Book. So that's a bit of a Bible of mine. I'd have a look at that. I have a look at Julia Cameron, The Artist's Way. Everybody's probably got that already.
Well, we're having a bit of a chuckle because Valerie Koo mentioned that's how she starts her day off, right, doing her morning pages.
The three pages. Of course. So they're my tips for that.
Fantastic.
And of course, read all my books.
Of course. That goes without saying. So what do you mean when you say that you're a creative disruptor?
Well, there's an idea. I've got that term actually from being part of a women's network in the Commonwealth Bank, where the conference was, the theme was creative disruption, I think. And it really made me think about this idea of if you're not making change through what you do, then what are you doing? You're just being static. Let's know what is the point? What is our purpose if we're not actually generating a shift in our area? So my area, obviously, is very much around social justice, and I want my writing, my creative writing, to force people to have a shift in the way that they think about other people, how our own behaviour impacts on other people, for good and bad. And I want educators to use Indigenous voices in the classroom and so forth. So I'm using my creativity in writing to disrupt the way in which people think about Indigenous Australia today. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, I might leave it there then.
Okay. I like that. Just before we move on to talk about something a bit different, do you have a favourite book that you've written and a favourite book that someone else has written?
Do you know, that's always a very difficult question for a writer because every book has something personal to us. But because, you know, and I've written across genres, but for the purpose of this podcast, I will say one of my favourite books that I've written would have to be Titters because it's set in Brisbane. And I had such a fantastic time researching it and learning about a city that until I was here researching, I didn't realise was such a gem. And I found Brisbane to be like the Mercedes in the garage that never gets driven or gets brought out on Sunday for the Sunday tribe, you know. And I thought, oh my God, this city is so undervalued and so underrated by people.
Don't tell everybody.
By people who don't know. So that when I wrote Titters, I never write about a city I've never been to. I try not to, and I write about places that I fall in love with and that I want other people to know about. So, you know, I'd written about Deniliquin in Paris Dreaming because, you know, lots of people never going to go to Denny. Likewise, a lot of people from Denny may never get to Paris, so it's set in those two cities. And I want both sets of people to know about these other cities. So when I wrote Titters, I was really genuinely surprised by the reaction, particularly from women in Brisbane who said, oh my God, that is so my city. And so I was really pleased about that and people reviewing it as a love letter to Brisbane. And so I think that I think I have so much of this was so much joy in that book. And then interestingly, I ended up buying the unit that one of my characters lived in back in 2012 when I was researching, and I've now moved into that unit, which is quite bizarre. And they said, oh, you're becoming Izzy. But Izzy finds out she's pregnant on page one. Her friends are going, oh, my God, what happens if you find out? I go, I'm going to be as surprised as Izzy was for different reasons. I'm older than Izzy. But anyway, so Titters.
I think my favourite book of yours is Titus as well, and partly that's because we met through you writing that book.
Well, Mel, there are scenes in that book. As
I
you know
there are.
Yes. an event that you and I went to.
Yeah.
And again, there were, you know, I have no shame with product placement in my novels for things that I appreciate and value. And, yeah, so that's right. And I actually have some good friends now in Brisbane who are from Twitter, including yourself, where I would, you know, I tweeted out, for example, I'm researching the Gap, where's the best coffee and so forth. And somebody tweeted, do you know, there's swingers night at the Gap Tavern on Monday nights. Now, who would have known that? Now, I went to the Gap Tavern on a Monday night, keys firmly in my handbag, didn't see any action going on at all, but obviously I don't know what I'm looking for either. But all I enjoyed was it was called Barra Monday. Now, what did they call it? Yeah, Barra Monday. So I had my Barra Monday. But it's amazing that also that's a really good point there, Mel, about the connection and the impact that social media relationships can have on your work, because my work in creating Titters was informed by and enriched by relationships that I formed on social media, like ours. So like there you go. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When I first started following you on Twitter, I had no idea who you were, and then you won a Deadly Award and I just went, oh, my God, she's famous and she talks to me on Twitter.
Well, Mel, I didn't know who you were either. I knew you blogged about food and I like food, so snap.
So that works.
Yeah, it works.
So just changing track a bit, you've recently become the manager of the Epic Good Foundation, which is based in Brisbane, and that's quite a change from writing and speaking. What prompted you to make that change?
Well, it's interesting because it was a big jump from moving away from obviously working, writing and doing classroom visits to assuming a managerial role. I'm managing just myself, actually, not manager of one, but and relocating states to do that. But I, it's again, it's that connection, the connections we make in various forums. I met Kathy Reid, who is a Brisbane-based pharmacist, through a CommBank Women's Network, and we became friends. And then earlier last year, I, having been writing for months on end, looked up one day and said, oh, dear, I haven't worked. I haven't had any paid work for 4 months because I've been working on books, and I don't have any work till July, and I've got 6 weeks in Europe that I need to do for various reasons. And I had a bit of a, I had about a 36-hour meltdown. Seriously, I was like, I was, this is not a good place to be financially. And I contacted three of the women in my network, in my banking network, who helped me just really quickly refocus the way I was thinking about writing, because obviously all my writing would be literary, and which doesn't generate the income that you need to cover mortgages and living generally, cover just living. So I did up a one-page flyer, and I sent it to three people. One of them was Kathy, and I said, I'm, you know, I'm looking for some paid work. This is what I'm interested in doing, bang, 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 which was around writing and social media. And she emailed me and said, we're looking for someone to do exactly what you're proposing. So it is about the art of the ask, which I've learned, which is a very important message, and not being ashamed or embarrassed to ask, because it, what I've learned is for nearly every time I've asked for something, I haven't asked for many things, there have been more than enough people willing to help. So,
I was going to say, I think that's it, isn't it? Like, you put me onto Amanda Palmer's book and TED Talk, The Art of the Ask, which I haven't read her book yet, but it's on the pile, in the pile. And but watching her TED Talk made me realise that asking is very important, but you don't want to be known as that person who always asks and always takes. And I think it's about strategically asking the right people at the right time. And then people realise that, okay, you are serious with this ask, and you'll be grateful when you receive, and you'll do something beneficial with what you receive, rather than those people who ask constantly for everything and show no gratitude and have this degree of expectation that they'll get everything they want.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there were a couple of things that you've just pointed out there that were absolutely obvious to me when all this happened, and that was, one, the three people I reached out to in various ways I had helped previously as friends, as, because that's what friends do, but I'd helped them with their projects. And then that was one thing. And then the other thing was, when I approached Kathy, I wasn't asking her for the work. I asked her if she knew anybody within her network. But it was about timing. It was purely about timing. They needed some of the time. Now what happened was, I was just writing remotely. That all went really well. I was working from, you know, from, I then was in Europe when I was doing writing for them, which obviously lots of things that we do in social media can be done anywhere. I found her and her partner, Stuart Giles, and the values that they brought to the work that they were doing through their foundation. So I met them, started writing copy for them in terms of the philanthropy they were doing and their work with the Indigenous program at Hawthorn Football Club. And I'm not an AFL person, but I saw a completely different way of considering sport and health and philanthropy. And so, and then, you know, very long story short, we were on the same page in terms of expectations of people who have the means to do good things strategically. So I can help them with their strategy. They've got the resources. I've got the strategies and the connections and the media savvy to help, you know, make all that worthwhile. So they basically said, we would like you to be a big part of our organisation. Bang, bang, bang. And then I, you know, started packing my bag the next day, because I want to be part of, you know, the epic good journey and be part of, it's completely different writing stories every day that are positive, when a lot of what we see obviously around Indigenous statistics that are real are quite negative. And I've been doing that for a very long time. And so it's good to be part of a process where I can highlight all this fantastic stuff that's going on as well. And so I can't imagine now not being a part of Epic Good. I just want to do this job forever.
Oh, I love that. That's mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It must be very satisfying.
It is.
Yeah.
It's really, it's, we, you know, hashtag, it's an hashtag Epic Good way to live.
You said earlier, and we said in your introduction, that you're an advocate for Indigenous literature and literacy. Why is that important to you?
I think lots of people probably assume I consider Indigenous literacy important because I'm a writer, but it's not about that at all, really. It's about the fact that reading, as you know, opens doors. It's about the fact that people like you and I live in cities where we have access to amazing public libraries where books are free. Many of us in cities today have homes with books and school libraries. And the reality is remote Australia does not have the resources that we enjoy so freely and probably often take for granted in the city. And the statistics around Indigenous people and remote communities are devastating in terms of our young people being so far behind the national standard in reading and writing. Now, the greater issues around that is when young people or even older people, regardless of heritage, cannot read and write the English language, what it means is they're relying on other people to make decisions for them. Now, when Indigenous people are relying on non-Indigenous people to make decisions for them in key areas of their lives, that is not self-determination. Now, we will only have self-determination as a group of people nationally when, as individuals, we can have control over our lives. And I've done role modelling tours with NASCA, which is the National Aboriginal Sporting Chance Academy, and I have worn a tracksuit on occasion.
I may have seen a photo of that.
Yes, it's not that attractive. But anyway, and I've seen young people in communities who are so fast and can kick footballs so far that I have no doubt that they can get picked up for selection by the major teams as they get older. Now, the truth is some of these kids cannot read street signs and cannot read labels on food and so forth. So there's health issues there. There's just basic day-to-day living issues there. So while I want people and our kids to be entertained and travel into outer space with fantastic literature, I also want them to be able to be safe so they can read warning signs and get through, you know, all that basic stuff that we take for granted. Now,
even something as simple as reading the instructions on prescription medication.
Exactly.
When do you take it? How often do you take it? What happens? You know, what do you do if you feel in a way that you shouldn't after you've taken it?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I personally believe that it is a race issue, because if those kids were just, if the news headlines were Australian children literacy rates at this, as opposed to Indigenous kids, that people would be far more concerned and up in arms about it, and we wouldn't have to have anything like the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, which is a community-run, grassroots, volunteer-based project which generates income, that if we just thought about these statistics as here's a group of Australians who can't read and write, what is the Commonwealth government doing about this? Now, we generate, I think we raised about $600,000 last year. We put books into 260 remote communities. This year we're aiming for 300 communities. Now, $600,000 is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. Yeah. And my question is, why isn't the government going, oh, my God, you guys are doing a fantastic job in terms of literacy workers on the ground. Here's $1 million a year for the next 15 years to... Like, that's not a lot of coin.
No.
No, it's not.
And they're flying choppers at $5,000 a pop to get from Melbourne to Geelong,
yep.
So to speak.
So how can our listeners get involved if they want to support the Indigenous Literacy Foundation?
Oh, well, they can get online easy. They can make a donation. That's one of the easiest things to do. They can organise a great book swap at their workplace or their school where people bring in their favourite book and they swap it for another book and a gold coin donation. So that's a great morning tea activity to do. It raises awareness and raises cash. We always need volunteers for events. So they can just get onto the Indigenous Literacy Foundation website and there'll be a drop down about how you can help. And it's interesting because every time we have a conversation or event, people come up straight away going, oh, my God, how can I participate? What can I do? I'm really fortunate because I've grown up with books. So we don't put secondhand books into communities because we believe that our children deserve to have brand new books like other yeah. children. The communities choose from a book list that the book industry has put together with literacy workers, and they are provided at cost. So we have a very small team of incredibly devoted staff. I think maybe there's four in the office. But basically everything else is on a volunteer capacity across authors, booksellers, publishers and so forth.
That's fantastic. That's excellent. So just to move on again to another subject, What does success look like to you?
Success. I think over time, like the idea of success has probably changed for me. Previously, the goal was to be a bestseller and be published by a multinational, and I did that back in 2007. And as you get older, I think for me success is really at the end of the day, just being happy about my job and being, I think as you get older, it's sort of like I've had a very successful day. I've ticked my boxes. I've come home. I'm going to bed without any stress. I emailed Stuart Giles, who's my boss, one of my bosses. So they'd say, don't say we're working together. You know, so I was hashtag boss, not boss. But we... I emailed him yesterday and I said, have you got 10 minutes to talk about the Hawthorne Indigenous Literacy stuff this week? And he said, okay, why don't we meet for a run in the morning and then we can have a breakfast meeting? I was like, oh, my God, am I the only staff member who's got to have a running work meeting? So we had a joke about that.
Well, I like walking meetings. So
yeah, no, I think
just that next step, isn't it?
It is. Mel, you and I can have a running meeting next.
No, I don't think so. We'll go for a walking meeting, thanks. Okay.
So we did the eight. We did an 8K run around the river and we sat down and we had a really productive meeting. And I sent him an email when I got to my podcast meeting an hour early because I'm ahead of myself. I'm just before my own time. And I sent him an email. And I just said to him, I want to thank you because this is a really positive way to start the day. So we made a decision this morning that we'll do a Tuesday run meeting. Every Tuesday we'll run. And so I think for me, my measure of success today is that I started off my day and I think as we get older, and I don't want to keep harping on about that, but I do think we shift what we think is important, what our values are and how we measure success. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's about the dollar signal. If I can get through if I can just pay off some credit cards, that's successful too.
Yeah.
But, you know, really I think I want my books to matter. I want my publishers to be happy. I want my readers to walk away thinking that they have gained something emotionally, intellectually, and possibly, you know, had a giggle along the way as well. They're all different measures of success as well.
I remember when I moved to Brisbane nearly 16 years ago, a lot of people said to me, I don't understand why you're moving to Brisbane. You'll earn so much more money if you stay in Sydney. And even when I was 30 and I said, money's not my main focus. Yeah. Health and happiness is. And I'd had a very bad health report card from my GP who said, you need to change your life significantly if you don't want to have a stroke before you turn 30. Mm. And, you know, hearing that when you're 29 is quite enlightening. And it just made me realize, yeah, there is a lot more to life than earning lots of money and being really stressed all the time.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah. My PhD supervisor used to say to me, oh, you'll be worth so much more with your PhD. And I said, I'm not doing this for money because I don't want to work in academia.
Yeah, that's right. I'm doing
this because I want structure around the research they want to do. Now, had I not enrolled in the PhD, I'd still be researching that thing now, you know, because I didn't have the structure. So, and when I went to my first business women's meeting conference, I was sitting there and people were turning over like $250 million and, you know, I had 400 staff or whatever, and there's just me who was earning $40,000 being a writer and had no staff. I'm going like, what am I doing here? I'm not motivated by money. I'm motivated by making social change.
Yeah, yeah. But I think we need all of those different motivations in different people in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But also what that conversation that I was in, I wasn't even in it, I was on the periphery of it, helped me redefine how I would move forward, because you can't live in Sydney on, well, you can, but unless I didn't want to be in debt. So it is about the whole idea about moving to Brisbane. Also, yes, you might earn more money in Sydney, but you spend more money there too.
Exactly.
So really, you know.
Yeah, perspective's a great thing, isn't it? Because sometimes learning about other people and what they deem successful can actually, you can work out for yourself what you don't want through that.
Yeah.
Which is a great way to learn, really.
No, they're absolutely right. Good point.
Yeah, I think so too. So do you have any big goals for 2016? You know, apart from learning to cook and maybe getting married.
Yes. Well, that's far enough. They're not linked, you know. I'm not learning to cook in order to help me get a husband.
I know you're not.
A smart man will cook for me or take me out. That's my theory. So,
you're very good at washing up.
And I don't mind washing up. And if anybody's listening, just throwing it out there. Well, my big goal for this year, I mean, I have contracts for books, right, because they'll come out. And that's for me, that's a given, because I know they will do that. My big goal is one of them is a personal goal, and that is I want to do the Outback Run around Uluru, a half marathon. So that's something I'm looking forward to. But also I just wanted to say, and it's related to goals, years ago I sat down with my life coach and she had my year calendar out and I had all the things, all the places I was going to be and the books I had to do and where I was travelling to. I was on the road a lot then, and she looked at it. She goes, what's wrong with this calendar, Anita? And I said, I don't know. It's, everything's there. She goes, no, have another look at it. I'm looking at it. And I used to get really cranky. I go, well, you know the answer. Tell me the answer. And I'm paying you. She's my friend, right? But I figured for the hour that I was paying her, I could scream and swear and be unkind. I think, tell me the answer. And she looked at it and she goes, nowhere in that calendar have you got a holiday. Right, yeah. So, and people who work for themselves are very good at forgetting that they need to have leave. And so I've just recently booked myself 2 weeks in Hawaii, and I usually do like a week or 9 days. I go, no, I'm taking 14 days and I'm going to Hawaii and I'm going to run every day and I'm going to do this. And so for me, that's quite a big deal. I mean, I'll do Europe and I'll do those sort of things, but there's always work on. And it's not really, like even when I was in Spain, I wrote every day, which was work, and then I would go and, you know, then I would go and drink sangria and whatever mojitos on the beach. But essentially there was working every day. So I think my goal for 2016 is really about being conscious of the need to take a step back and smell the roses, so to speak, and enjoy the time in the river. And Brisbane is the perfect place to do that.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
So finally, just before we wrap up, what's your top tip for people to get stuff done?
Stop talking about it. I can't tell you what happens. Nothing shits me more than people that start a sentence with, I'm gonna.
Oh, me too.
Yeah,
me too.
I'm gonna do this. You know what? Just fucking do it. No, okay, so delete that out. Top tip. Stop talking about it. Don't bore people with what you're going to do. Oh, just quietly go away and do it. That's my top tip. Stop boring people with what you're going to do.
I think I can be a gunner sometimes, so I'm just going to reframe that and say I'm doing this right now, and by February I'll have this done.
What's this? This podcast?
Well, this podcast is already up and running, so we've done that.
Yeah.
So what will I have done by February? By the end of February, because there's a fair bit to go on, I'll have revamped my Cook's Notebook blog.
Okay.
I'll have launched my second podcast related to that blog, and I will have developed 2 products to sell.
Wow, that's a lot. You could have just done one, you know.
But 2 of them are almost, you know, in my head, they're all thought out and planned out, and they just have to be done. Okay. So the research and the thinking part for 2 of them is already done.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, okay, end of February.
All right. That's now in the public domain. You can't take that back.
I could edit that out still, though.
Yeah, good.
And by the time we release this episode, it'll probably be the end of February. I'll be able to do a little spiel at the beginning to say where I'm at.
Brilliant.
Yes. Okay. What are you going to do, Annette, by the end of February? I'm going to put her on the spot now.
Annette, can I just say, I sold a business last week that I'd had for 16 years.
Mm.
So... What am I going to do by the end of February? Well, I do know what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be packing a suitcase and going to Bali for a month.
Why did I ask her?
Yeah, no, why? I was going to say to her, why don't you by the end of February spend X amount of dollars from the sale?
Oh, well, yeah.
Because it doesn't all have to be work-related either.
No.
You know, it can be, and I think... Again, it's about the age thing where you just go, right, we're all so conditioned to thinking that goals have to be about work. And I guess because we work for ourselves also, we all, and when you're a business owner of whatever the business is, you're driven by, you have to be because you're responsible and accountable and the buck stops with you. But, you know, I think we need to set 3 goals, and one is the personal and one is the professional and one is the health.
Yeah, I completely agree. I had a little chuckle when you said a few minutes ago that most people who work with themselves forget about holidays. The main reason I started working for myself was so I could have more holidays.
Mm.
And my holiday goal every year is 12 weeks. I did it last year for the first time, and I don't know whether I'll get there this year, but I'll get close, I think, again this year. But I take my laptop on holiday with me, so I do a little bit of work as well, but not to the same extent that I do work when I'm sitting in my office at home.
No, that's right. Well, good.
Yeah, so I'll keep you posted with that.
Please do.
Mine will be cemented on Saturday. I'm going to a workshop for the day where our whole focus is 2:16. So from that, I'm pretty sure I'll have mapped out, and you know, end of February, I should know what that will be too.
Excellent.
Well, good luck, ladies.
That's exciting. Well, that wraps it up. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Anita.
Thank you.
Can you just let people know how they can get in touch with you via social media? So obviously you're on Twitter at. But, well, we'll let you tell what your Twitter handle
is. Sure. Easy to find me on Twitter. It's just at Anita Heiss. Instagram is Dr. Anita Heiss.
Mm.
Or when you look at it, it just looks like Dranita Heiss. I have a public Facebook page. Again, you can find me, Anita Heiss, surprise, surprise. And my website is www.anitaheiss.com, and you can link to my blog. You can get to my blog from there. So, and... Booksellers online, Booktopia, Bookworld, most of those places have my books. So
great. And also your book tour that's coming up in Dublin later this year. Let's give that a quick plug as well.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to be in Dublin in September running an 8-day masterclass for a small group of very lucky listeners who want to enrol. And we will look at the art of writing popular fiction as opposed to unpopular fiction. I think that's an interesting thing. And we'll create characters. We will use our senses when we'll go to the Guinness Brewery. We'll We'll do some sightseeing. We'll have somebody guide us around and we will have a blast. But the big thing is you will come out with your synopsis, with a plan for your book and hopefully a few thousand words into it.
Fantastic. And we'll put the link for how people can enroll in that on the website in the show notes.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, ladies. That was fun.
That was.
Thanks for listening to the Activity Pod. Continue the conversation over at theactivitypod.com, where you'll find the show notes and all the other fantastic episodes, together with links to our Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivitypod, or tweet us at theactivitypod, where you'll find Annette and Mel every day. Theactivitypod.com is also a place where you can connect with Annette and Mel directly. Thanks for joining us today as we find better ways to help you focus, become more productive, and get stuff done so that you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want from life. We'd love you to join us in our next episode, where we look forward to helping you with accountability so that you can get stuff done.